This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is the GHIL lecture by Wolfgang Knöbel, director of the Hamburg Institute of Social Research, on the problem with historical processes, reflections on an under-theorized topic. Talk of social processes is widespread in historiography as well as in the social sciences. Process terms such as industrialization, urbanization, individualization, secularization, etc. are ubiquitous. Nevertheless, it is usually rather unclear what processes actually are, how they should be theorized, and what types of processes can be distinguished. The lecture will first pose the question of why these process terms came to dominate the social sciences in the first place. Then it will attempt to prove the thesis that process claims inevitably entail narrative elements, and finally conclude that plausible process claims cannot be made without knowledge of narratological arguments.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm really proud to be here. Thank you very much for the kind introduction and your kind words. Let me start with, I think, two remarks which are important if one talks about processes in an interdisciplinary context. First of all, the ideas which I will present came out of a rather odd situation at the Frias in Freiburg, right, long time ago, maybe 8 or 9 years, maybe even longer, when there was a conference in global history organized by Hans Joers, by Jürgen Osterhammel and myself. And it was, I think, a very good conference, but at the end, some people asked questions which were a little bit odd. And one of the questions was, what actually is a process in theoretical terms? And this troubled the participants of the conference because, you know, the answer was always, well, a process is, a process is something which goes on, okay? So that was not really clear. I believe everybody was troubled by this kind of question, and it has a lot to do, I would say, with the history of the discipline of sociology, and maybe there are some troubles within the disciplines which are not only related to the social sciences, but maybe also to history as a discipline. But let me talk first about sociology, just a kind of a preliminary remark. Sociology, I would say, after 1945, that's not true for the sociological classics like Max Weber, but after 1945, sociology was created as a kind of a discipline that should explain social order. Sociology was in German a Ordnungswissenschaft, a science that deals with order. Tocqueville Parsons is one of the major figures within world sociology, and American focused, I believe, his whole work from the very beginning on this topic of social order. How can we solve the so-called Hobbesian problem if people are fighting to each other so that in the end, a war against all people will be avoided? So how is social order possible? And I believe that all the debates up from the 1940s up, I would say, to the present, are very much focused on this question of order. Of course, sociology has subdisciplines, the subdisciplines of social movements, for example. But it's only a subdiscipline. The sociology as a discipline was never really able to theorize processes. Processes were taken for granted when we were talking about individualization or industrialization or secularization, etc., etc. So we always thought, as sociologists, we know what we are talking about. But in fact, in theoretical terms, we had a lot of difficulties in explaining what is a process. And I believe that might be a problem for historians as well, not only for sociologists. And that's how I came to my topic. And I was asking myself different questions, and these different questions will be the topic of my talk tonight. So I believe when you are talking about social problems and social processes, you probably have to ask a variety of questions. The first question, of course, is what was the historical context when processual terms, I read it out now, have been established within historiography and the social sciences? The emphasis is on context, because when you look into the history of the social sciences, processual terms were not there at the very beginning, and they didn't continue all the time up to the present. It was always a particular phase in that particular processual terms were coined and used. So my first question will be, why did such processual terms come up? What was the time? And who coined these kinds of processual terms like industrialization, secularization, rationalization, etc., etc.? The next question, which is important for me, is when and why did processual terms become dominant? This is a different question. It's not about the context when these processual terms were invented or created or coined, but when did these processual terms become dominant, hegemonial, you would say? And these were completely different time phases we have to talk about. The third question is, who is actually the observer of social processes? I mean, when you're talking about secularization or urbanization, I mean, you don't see it. It's not like a house. It's not like a thing. Probably there is somebody who observes processes. Probably somebody who observes processes has to be a narrator, has to talk about processes. So the question immediately comes up, can we observe processes and how do we present them? And that this, I think, is a problem which was not very successfully dealt within the social sciences. Maybe the historians have a different perspective, but within the social sciences, I believe we had always a lot of problems in observing and describing these social processes. And the fourth question is, what are scholars doing when they are talking about processes? And this is the part of my talk when I am using topics from narratology in order to question some of the assumptions of those people who are talking about social processes within the social sciences. And I would like to offer at least 6 points, which are important for me coming from narratology, in order to make clear why social scientists and maybe historians should use knowledge from narratology in order to improve their talk about social processes. So this is basically the structure of my talk. And the talk will be a little bit abstract. Of course, I have only 40 minutes left or so. So I will be very quick, just hinting at some points, but I think we have the chance in the discussion to go into more detail. So my first question, what was the historical context when processual terms have been established within historiography and the social sciences? And I strongly believe that it was the German philosopher Hegel who basically set up the problem which all the historians and social scientists after him had to deal with. So Hegel, of course, is a difficult topic. I'm not going into detail here, but you could say it in a nutshell, maybe, that when Hegel in the 1820s and early 1830s wrote his philosophy of history, it was in a sense, and you know, don't take it too well, I'll be very brief. He basically tried to make clear that the history of mankind can be understood as a kind of development, as a kind of teleological development. You can see, in a sense, the seeds and the origins of the present, even in many, many thousand years before, in antiquity, let's say, or in Egypt. And history is a dialectical process. It's a logical process, in a sense, and it leads up to our present, to the Prussia of Hegel. Now, this, of course, is a kind of a philosophy of history, a rather speculative, a rather metaphysical philosophy of history. But Hegel, of course, was in the 20s and 30s rather influential. And my argument would be that when you're looking into the establishment of the discipline of history in the 1830s, 1840s, and 1850s in Germany, you will see how the historians who wanted to be empirical scholars, not metaphysical scholars, had to deal with the question of Hegel, had to deal with his philosophy of history. Could the historians, that is the question, offer a better solution than Hegel in the 1840s and 1850s and 1860s when the discipline was established, a better solution in Hegel in order to overcome relativism and subjectivism? Because for Hegel, it was quite clear he has a kind of an anchor point of history. This is the present. All history is running up to the present. There's no question of relativism. Hegel knows quite well how to order history, how to put the facts into a particular scheme. And of course, it is also not a problem of subjectivity. It's not Hegel who, as a person, writes history. It is the spirit of the world, the Weltgeist, who writes this kind of history. And Hegel is only the interpreter of this kind of Weltgeist. So Hegel offered a philosophy of history without relativism and without subjectivity or subjectivism. Now the historians after him, and I would like to focus and talk a little bit about Ranke and Droysen, basically wanted to be empirical scholars. They wanted to get rid of the heritage of Hegel, the legacy of Hegel. And for Ranke, maybe it was not that a big problem, but for Droysen it was, because Droysen, in fact, was a kind of a student of Hegel. So for him, it was particularly difficult in order to get rid of this Hegelian thinking. Now, what in the end did they do? Now, when Ranke, in his methodological writings, tried to reflect on the things which he was doing, he immediately came to the problem of relativism again. And when you look into his writings before the Bavarian Academy of Science, where he put down his methodological ideas, you immediately realize that Ranke made quite clear that we can order history, and we know that we are writing the right history because we know that there is God. We believe in God. We believe that the history is a kind of a Christian achievement. And God is basically our anchor point of history, which helps us to avoid, in the end, relativism and subjectivism. So Ranke is going back to a kind of metaphysical, or you could even say a religious idea, in order to structure history. It's not an arbitrary construct which I, Ranke, am offering. It's a kind of an offer I give you because I know that it's God which is behind me. Now that, of course, is rather metaphysical and religious, but in the end, Droysen in his historic, in his lectures in Berlin, I think it was, when was it, in the middle of the 1850s, in the historic has one very, I would say, interesting passage where he's reflecting again about relativism and subjectivism. And he's asking one rather important question. And in fact, in the formulation he uses, it's a rather racist question. And the question goes as follows, and I tried to translate it by memory, and the question goes that way. Do we as historians have to be interested in any tribe in Africa? Do we have to be interested in any state of their so-called Hottentot? Do we have to theorize and to write about any event in world history? No, we don't, was his answer, because if we would do that, we would get lost in thousands and millions of facts. That is not the solution we can offer. We can, however, offer a kind of a solution, and that he makes quite clear. What we are interested in is not in some African tribes and their state. What we are interested in is the idea of the state. We are not interested in any family. We are interested in the idea of family. Now, what Droysen, by saying this, is doing is he's going back to Hegel, in fact, in some sense, and arguing we cannot go to all the details and all the archives of all mankind, but we have to focus along theoretical ideas, our historical research. And the idea of the state gives us an indication what is important and what is not important. So my basic claim is that both Ranke and Droysen in their methodological writings focused very much on metaphysical and philosophical ideas, a kind of a philosopher of history as well, in order to avoid relativism and subjectivism. That was their last anchor point. Either the idea of something like a Hegelian would say, or God in the case of Rankine. Now, in the end, what that shows is that even those empirical working historians were not really able to get rid of this kind of philosophy of history. Now, when you're looking into the second half of the 19th century, something strange comes up, because you probably know quite well that the era of Hegel was over in the middle of the 19th century. Other currents within philosophy came up. And one of the most important currents was Neo-Kantianism, Neo-Kantianismus. And the philosophers of Neo-Kantianism, among them Rickard and Windelband, I would say rather surprisingly, began to deal with the philosophy of history as well, which is not so clear why they did, but obviously they had the feeling we have to deal with the problem of relativism and subjectivism as well. And Rickard, for example, even wrote a whole book about the history, the philosophy of history. And this book is called Probleme der Geschichtsphilosophie. I would say not really to be expected, but nevertheless, he did it. And what was his argument? His argument basically was, well, it is true that Hegel, in some sense, solved the problem, but we as Neo-Kantians, of course, are not Hegelians any longer. So we have to base our arguments on a different kind of logic. And when he was talking about the philosophy of history, he came up with the idea, well, there are, in fact, objective values. We have to believe in objective values, because if we don't believe in objective values, the history and the writing of history becomes arbitrary again, becomes a kind of subjectivism, becomes a kind of relativism. Now, even the Neo-Kantians, my argument would be, relied on a certain kind of a philosophy of history, and again, based on rather metaphysical ideas, objective values. Max Weber, of course, and now I'm coming to these processual terms. Max Weber, of course, was a student or was influenced by Rickard and Windelband. But of course, as you all know, or those who have read Max Weber, of course, couldn't believe in objective values. There are no objective values. Values are always contested. Now, Max Weber, influenced by Neo-Kantianism, didn't believe in objective values. And of course, again, the Hegelian problem comes up for him for this reason. How can we avoid relativism then? How can we avoid subjectivism if there are no objective values? And I believe, and this is my interpretation, and of course, you can always contest this kind of interpretation. I believe that Max Weber, in a sense, particularly in the end of his career, for this very reason, Max Weber, particularly in the end of his career, coined this very robust processual terms. Particularly, as you know, the most famous one, rationalization. So he argued, in a sense, not in a Neo-Kantian, but I would even say in a realist way, so as if he would have said, look, rationalization is something you can really observe. It's so hard, so robust. Nobody can really try to contest that there are these processes of rationalization. So in order to come over the problem of relativism and subjectivism, I believe Max Weber coined these very robust processual terms. And of course, he didn't invent it. Isations, Isierungen, did exist before him. But he was the one within the social sciences who introduced these kinds of terms in a very prominent and a very influential way. Now, Max Weber found this kind of solution in order to overcome subjectivism and relativism. But the question is that really a good solution? Because these kind of robust terms might have in themselves some problems. Anyway, I would argue that from Max Weber onwards, the social sciences created these kinds of processual terms, used them, but, and then I come to my next question, and this is the slide before that, these isations didn't become dominant before, I would say, the 1950s and the 1960s. Max Weber invented them, not in the sense of inventing, but introduced it into the social sciences, but they became only dominant after the Second World War. What happened, I would say, in the period between the wars? Max Weber, as you know, died in 1920. I believe that there were basically in the Weimar Republic, and when you're talking and focusing on Germany in exile, there were basically four attempts to solve the Hegelian problem of relativism and subjectivism. The first solution was used for a couple of years, not during his whole career, by Karl Mannheim, when he created the discourse on generations. I wrote almost biology. Of course, Mannheim was not a biologist, and he never really argued biologically. But the assumption in the background was we can identify generations basically without any much contestations, because there are generations, and these generations are the driving forces of history. I believe that this idea, in order to get rid of relativism and subjectivism, existed within his own oeuvre only for a couple of years, because for strange reasons, and I actually don't know why, his famous essay on generations was never used by him afterwards any longer. But of course, the discourse on generations plays a huge role in the social sciences after 1945, and particularly after 1980s and 1990s, when the 60s generations began to theorize themselves. So Karl Mannheim tried to use one solution. It was a near-biological one, although he probably would never have said this in this way, but it was a kind of a getting out of this problem of subjectivism and this problem of relativism. Norbert Elias, in the in-between war periods, had a kind of a Weberian solution. He didn't talk about rationalization, of course. He talked about civilizational processes. So probably no need to talk about him, because the arguments are very similar to the ones of Max Weber, although they had a different term. The Frankfurt School is an interesting case. As you know, the Frankfurt School came out of Marxism, but when you read in the 1920s and 1930s essays of particular Horkheimer, you will find a kind of a strange idea, I would say. Not a strange idea, but I mean, it's not self-evident. Horkheimer, of course, was not an orthodox Marxist. But Horkheimer, in some of his essays, although he very much criticized bourgeois thinking as strong as possible, although he did this, he had one hero within bourgeois thinking, and this was Giambattista Vico. And Horkheimer argued, in a sense, we have this kind of legacy of Vico, because Vico was the first one who has argued that we, as social scientists and historians, can understand history even better than the natural world, because we are part of the historical world themselves. So what he did was, Horkheimer made strong this kind of philosophical, anthropological argument coming from Vico, and then made clear what we are doing when we are doing social science or history. We are not doing it in an arbitrary or relativistic way. We can really know history. We know it. We are at least possible to know history and to teach and to learn history without any subjectivism and without any relativism. So Vico, for surprising reasons, maybe not for surprising reasons, but for logical reasons, became of a very important reference author for the Frankfurt School, because Vico made it clear that you don't have to be a relativist in order to do history. Now, orthodox Marxism, of course, was the other solution, the fourth solution in the interwar period, by essentializing classes and class conflict. So when you believe in classes and the existence of classes and the class struggle, there is no need to talk about relativism any longer. Classes are there. You see them. They will constitute them. They will emerge. And the class struggle will give you an idea how history really works. And there's a kind of teleology in it, but it's a teleology which is in Marx and in Hegel, and it's a logical process. No subjectivism any longer. So this was the interwar period. To summarize it again up until here, Max Weber coined these Bureaucratizations, in a sense, used it because it talked about bureaucratization, as you know, rationalization, etc., etc. Of course, people did in the Weimar Republic as well, but here you see there were different kinds of attempts to solve the problem of relativism and subjectivism. Now, what happened after 1945? Why and when did these processual terms become so dominant? I believe that a lot of influences came together in order to make these processual terms so dominant. It's a complex story. I probably don't have the time to talk about it in all detail, but I would argue that at least at the beginning of the 1960s, that's an interesting story, maybe we can talk about in a discussion, the term modernity became established within the social sciences. And in some sense, there was later onwards a kind of hidden cooperation within Germany, let's say between Reinhard Koselleck and Niklas Luhmann in this kind of semantic history. And in this context, it was one of the sources where the term modernity was created and coined. I would say not before that, or only weakly before that, not strongly before that. And the idea basically was then, at least within the sociologists, within Luhmann and then other sociologists, since we know, and I will show you some graphics afterwards, since we know that we are living in modernity, since we know what modernity is, we again have a kind of an anchor point from which we can interpret the whole human history. History is a kind of a path towards modernity. I believe the strong talk about modernity has a lot to do in order to overcome relativism and subjectivism. And I would like to show you some graphs. So this is a graph from the Deutsches Digitales Wörterbuch, the Deutsche Sprache, about Modernisierung. As you can see, it's a strange kind of paragraph and strange kind of graph. You have in the 1950s a peak here, small peak, and you have a peak here in the 1970s and 80s. Then it's going downwards with modernization, and it has a lot to do with two developments. First, this peak can be explained by the use of modernization within organizational studies, management studies, etc., etc. German newspapers, the Spiegel, the FAZ, the Süddeutsche, talked enormously about modernization after the Second World War. Some influences came from France. Modernization means just here in this sense, improvement of technical organizational things. You can improve management. You can improve the banks. You can improve the infrastructure of the Deutsche Bahn, still necessary today. But I mean, that discourse in the middle of 1950s ended. It started again with the rise of modernization theory, which came from the US. And then the term modernization was basically used in order to describe broad, large-scale social processes, like traditional societies are going towards modernity, are becoming modern societies by individualization, bureaucratization, urbanization, etc., etc. Some more graphs, which I always find still rather surprising. When you look into Google's Engel viewer and you look into the adjective modern, you will see that modern is basically used all the time. Modern, modernus is a Latin word, so you can find it even in antiquity, etc., etc. So you have it a lot. Modernity, and I show other graphs as well, doesn't exist until here. It only starts here in 1980s or 1970s. And that is not something which is only happening in England or in Britain, but also in other countries. So here's the graph, a different one, about modernity is a kind of a term being important within artistry. It's not an epoch. Modernity only starts as a designation of an epoch in the 1960s, late 1960s. So the talk about modernity begins at that point. And the same is true with moderne in German. it's basically the same graph. It's not a big difference. Moderne, people are talking about Moderne not before the 1970s, 1980s. Moderne is an epoch, not as an art historical term. Of course, people were talking about, let's say, Picasso as somebody who belongs to modern art or so, and therefore belongs to modernity. But as an epoch of a whole society with all their structures, modernity is a rather recent term. And the same is true with Spanish, even more clearly can that be shown. Modernidad is basically, again, something which is created in the 1970s and not before. Well, if you look into these data, and I forgot French, by the way, it's basically always the same. When you look into these data, you wonder, what does basically modernity mean? Now I'm coming soon to my third part. I give you some examples. The publication list of books with titles or subtitles modernity is just enormous. And I'm talking about my discipline, sociology, and so, well, I can do that. I'm not hurting historians. Sociologists are completely crazy, I believe, because the number of books claiming they are talking about modernity is just enormous. The point is not that there is an epochal term, modernity. The point is that modernity nowadays doesn't have barely any content, which means that sociologists using adjectives in order to specify the term modernity. So you have regressive modernity, digital modernity, colonial modernity, hybrid modernity, liquid modernity, la modernidad mestiza, la modernidad ignorante. You can name it. So the number of titles and subtitles is just enormous. And not only that, there has been a kind of a pluralization of the term modernity. We are now talking within sociology about modernity. And my favorite subtitle and my favorite title is on the right side, Varieties of Multiple Modernities. Whatever that means, but it seems to be that as a sociologist, maybe it's sometimes true for historians as well, you cannot get rid of the term modernity. You must use it. Maybe it sells, I don't know. But the meaning of it becomes, I believe, rather ridiculous if you use all the time new terms in order to denote this very meaningless term, modernity. You need an adjective. And the last thing, maybe you have read it in the newspaper, at least the German ones, Eva Illo's new book is called Explosive Modernity, which just came out a couple of days ago. So my question would be, what does it actually mean when all these sociologists are talking about these kind of modernities? Well, anyway, the third part, I will try to talk about who is the observer of social processes. Can we observe processes at all? When you are talking about modernization, as I said, the term modernization became dominant within modernization theory in the 1950s and 1960s. You have to be aware that this term is the most abstract, the most encompassing term you can use as a professional term, because when people are usually talking about modernization, they are also talking about sub-process. When you're talking about modernization, you're also talking about individualization, you're talking about urbanization, you're talking about secularization, you're talking about basically everything. Now, the assumption within modernization theory always was, in a sense, that all these sub-processes are going together in a harmonious way. So a country which modernizes in the sense that the economy grows, will in the end come to a rather democratic political culture, will become a rather individualistic country. So that was the argument. My point is here that these very general terms, which have so many subterms below it, are rather useless, because the assumption that these subprocesses are going together is a very metaphysical assumption. You cannot really prove it empirically. It's just an assumption that individualization and democratization and urbanization, etc., are going together. That, I think, you cannot prove. So within the social sciences, you have a lot of encompassing, very general processual terms, and they are problematic in any sense. Nevertheless, I would argue that as social scientists, And as historians, we have to use professional terms. You cannot avoid it. Of course, we have to talk about industrialization. Of course, you have to talk about urbanization, etc. But my claim is that in the end, when you are talking about these processes, there's always a kind of a hidden philosophy of history behind it. And the problem, I think, is here, either you have a good philosophy of history, a controlled philosophy of history, or a really bad and uncontrolled philosophy of history. And now I come to the last part of my talk, where I will make six at least points in order to improve the use of processual terms within history and the social sciences. And I would focus first on the problem of the enchainment of events. Again, in order to contextualize my argument, my point here is, if we are using processual terms and we cannot avoid it, we should at least study narratological arguments, because within this discipline of narratology, you get a lot of ideas how to control your processual narratives. And these 6 points are all coming out from different narratological authors. First of all, if one, and here read it out, if one uses a term such as urbanization or individualization, then one connects events. Yeah, you have an event at time T1 and another one time T2, T3, etc., etc. So you're connecting, you're enchaining events. And by this enchainment, a story emerges, which is important. And this kind of story explains the outcome. Yeah, you have a kind of a story, and the outcome is explained by the very existence of the story, because you have enchained events. One event follows the other and leads to a certain kind of result. Now, when you are aware that you are enchaining events, you must be quite aware of the fact that other people, other historians, other social scientists might enchain different events. Events are not out there. You are always looking for events in order to create a good story. Now, the point simply here is, since you cannot observe a process, you must be aware, you cannot observe it directly, you must be aware that what you are doing is you are enchaining events. And if you are enchaining events, you are creating a narrative. And other people are basically able, or in principle at least, able to create different narratives, to create different stories. So this is the first argument. It's a simple argument, but nevertheless, I believe rather important. The second point, which is here stated at the slide, most sociologists, I don't believe that is always the case with the historians, but most sociologists are not really aware of the fact, which sounds stupid, of course, but I think it's true when you read sociological treatises, are not aware of the fact that choosing a different starting point and choosing a different endpoint creates a completely different story usually. So when you're talking about a process, you should be aware that choosing your starting point, when did secularization begin? When did urbanization begin? When did individualization begin? Choosing such a starting point gives you a particular kind of a story and not another one. And the same is true with the endpoint. When we are talking about the fall of the GDR, let's say, it is different whether you use some data in the early 1980s or whether you use some data in 89, et cetera, or if you would say, well, I mean, you have to be aware that there could have been a different come out as well. So choosing starting and endpoints is enormously important in order to create a history and to create a story. And you have to be aware that you should do that in a very careful way, not in order to get the story or to put the story on the wrong track. Why is that important? Well, for sociologists, it's important that for most sociological narratives, modernity is the endpoint. Since the epochal term modernity is so important, sociologists usually try to paint a picture of the past which leads, let's say, from the Middle Ages up to the present. And the present is just now somehow. There's no reflection in many of the sociological narratives whether it would be possible to choose an earlier starting point or maybe to choose a different endpoint. Modernity has become such a strong thing, almost like a thing, that you are not even reflecting on it any longer. It becomes clear the past is running up to the present. And this makes sociological narratives often very teleological. You have a telos. The telos is modernity, and it's the endpoint of a particular kind of a process. And you have to be aware that in this sense, sociologists, I believe, are always in danger to give a completely wrong sometimes or even one-sided or biased picture of previous times, since everything before modernity is different from modernity, because you have the story that runs from tradition to modernity, then you as a sociologist are not really interested in the medieval age or in antiquity, etc., because you know what's going on. The endpoint of history is here, it's modernity. All other things are just a prehistory of modernity. That makes many of the stories within sociology very teleological. Third point, I believe what you can learn from treatises on narrative is the simple fact the longer the time span is, which is used in order to build a processual terms, the less plausible the whole story becomes. Because if you're trying to connect hundreds of years, and some people even do it with thousands of years, if you're trying to connect that, then of course the question of arbitrary events that you are enchaining is basically enormous. I believe that processual terms that cover only a rather short period are the more legitimate, the more plausible ones. Processual terms which have a too long a history do have some problems. And as you might know, the debate within sociology, sometimes within history, about the so-called axial age, you know, the time long, long before Christ, were in some sense declared to be decisive for the history of modernity. I think this is a rather speculative and metaphysical thing. So if you are using terms as processes or processual terms, try to avoid too long time spans, because the metaphysical background becomes just uncontrollable. One point which is also important, why not choosing too long or too big a time span? When you're talking about different processes, let's say about urbanization, you have to be aware that your entities and the events you are enchaining are probably not the same any longer. When you're talking about, let's say, urbanization from the Middle Ages to the present time, the problem still might be that your entity, the medieval city or a medieval village, is a completely different thing than a modern city and a modern village. Though the entities that you are enchaining are changing historically. Since they are changing historically, it is rather difficult, in fact, in order to make a plausible argument which sounds a little bit like causality. That simply doesn't work any longer. So as a historian or a historically interested sociologist, you must be aware that the events that you are enchaining in your story, in your narrative, are themselves transforming by the way of history. And that makes it completely difficult in order to make narratives which span a very long time. Fifth point, it is probably very hard, always very hard, to avoid teleology. Some people within narratology, of course, would argue every story has some kind of teleological implications. You start with something and it comes to an end. When you're talking about the fall of the GDR, of course, the telos is in some sense always, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall. But the question, of course, is, do we have to be as deterministic in this way as usually many of the social science narratives go? Is there a possible outcome also on the table, on the agenda? And many of the narratives within the social sciences are, I would say, too deterministic, simply because they take for granted that the GDR has to go down in, I don't know, autumn 89. So the creation of these narratives about the fall of the GDR is usually then focusing on all the problematic things which happened in the GDR, not on others. And that makes the whole story very teleological and very deterministic. And the sixth point, which is also rather important and which is important for social research on individualization, and I would make that point rather clear here, stories are only plausible in a particular kind of context. A story only works if it is placed in a proper setting. It's like a joke that you're telling. Some jokes are not really appropriate in the wrong company, obviously. And the same is true with stories. Stories not always work in the same way. So they need a particular kind of a context. And within sociology, and I don't know whether historians are dealing with the same problems, within sociology, for example, there is a huge debate about the term individualization and the German term individual. Because when you are reading stuff coming out from other cultures, let's say from South America or Africa, the term the individual is something which is not really appropriate there for a variety of reasons. And social researchers coming from these areas are trying to avoid this kind of term for the very reason that the term individuum, the individual, has a lot of negative consequences. An individuum originally was male, it was white, it was, you know, situated in the European context, and only this person who is white, male, and a European or North American is a true individuum, a true individual. So a lot of context from this very ethnocentric background goes into the idea of the individuum, which is very contested in other contexts as well. And if you're using a term like individuum or the individual, and then making an isation term out of it, a processual term, then you're carrying with it all these ethnocentric connotations with the original term. So again, one should be aware that it might be a problem that the socio-political context of some terms is rather problematic. Maybe just one thing more, and then I come to the conclusion. I believe it's always a kind of a difficulty, sometimes not to be avoided, but it is, that many of these isations built out of terms which the Scottish philosopher Galley has called essentially contested concepts. Democracy is such an essentially contested concept. Basically, a lot of people, the majority of people, find democracy a very good thing. The definition of democracy is very difficult. There is a lot of contestation about the truth of democracy. Nevertheless, this essentially contested concept is used as a processual term, which makes it again very difficult in order to get an idea what does really this kind of change of social change really mean when people are talking about democratization. Is that something which is happening only here in Europe? Is that something which happens in other parts of the world? Since the original term democracy is essentially contested, the processual term, I would say, is even more, and we should be aware of that. That is true for democracy, for the individual, etc., etc. So 6 points I would have liked to offer you in order to improve this kind of use of processual terms. I would stress it again, you probably never will avoid it. The social sciences and the historical disciplines probably always will use it. But there's always a kind of a danger in these processual terms, and narratology, I would think, could help you in order to avoid the biggest problems. My conclusion, 2 things. In order to avoid pitfalls, I think you can use this kind of narratological arguments, but some processual terms you can always also criticize or at least question by asking, is there a reasonable theory of action behind these processual terms? Does it make sense, let's say, to talk about urbanization, to talk about individualization, etc., if by using these kind of processual terms, are these processual terms based on a particular understanding or conception of human action? Many of these, I would say, processual terms, I would choose here as an example, secularization, are basically used on the, or basically created on the picture of mankind is a very rational being. So secularization is going on because science is getting forward, is becoming more influential, and therefore people are not believing in God any longer. So it's a rather rational, a rather, I would say, one-sided understanding of human mankind in order to make this kind of argument plausible. To put it in a nutshell, I not only believe that narratology will help you in order to improve your processual terms, but also reflections about a theory of action. What are the possibilities of action of human mankind in order to criticize or question particular kinds of processual terms? And the last point, which is also important, and I was surprised that at least some historians are going into the same direction. I believe in order to make your narratives less teleological, counterfactuals can help. Of course, building counterfactuals is always a very difficult and also a very problematic thing, because we never know what would have happened, of course. But asking the question, what would have happened, sometimes help you in order to make your narrative more contingent, to make it less deterministic, because you're reflecting then on the question, maybe there could have been another outcome. Maybe it was not necessary that in 1989 the GDR was falling down, etc. It was very much more contingent. And therefore, I would conclude with one sentence, focusing on this kind of contingency, which narratology and maybe using counterfactuals would help us to bring together more closely than in the past the different systematic disciplines within the social sciences on the one side and history as a discipline on the other side. And there I would like to close. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.